At this time, I'd like to introduce the presenter for session one, Dr. Robert Hoyt. Dr. Hoyt will present on the evolution of captives from the 1800s to modern time. He is the Dudley L. Moore Jr. Chair and Professor of Risk Management Insurance in the Terry College of Business at the University of Georgia. His research interests are focused in the areas of corporate hedging, enterprise risk management, catastrophe risk management, insurer operations, economics of insurance fraud, liability system cost, and insurance insolvency. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Hoyt. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It's certainly my pleasure to be here today. Many people know that as a university professor with an attendance policy, I'm used to speaking to a captive audience, but this takes that term to a new level. So anyway, certainly my pleasure to be with you, and I might add, I actually got a few ideas for my own attendance policy based on the password structure here as well. So again, very much a pleasure to be with you today. Let me just tell you briefly what I'd like to share with you in this opening section. The agenda is listed here, but again, my role as I envision it is to really set the foundation. Many of you have differing involvements and experience levels within the captive insurance arena. So what I'm seeking to do at least is to provide at least a foundational level of information around which the following detailed panel discussions can actually build. So as noted, one of the things that I set out to try to establish initially was just to comment a little bit on the history of captives. You know, how did we get to the place that we're at now in the U.S. and globally with captive insurance organizations? So some of these things could be debated, but ultimately, as you look at the literature, most would suggest that really the origins of captives go back all the way to kind of the origins of the modern insurance industry, and that's at Lloyd's. In Lloyd's, obviously, there were organizations that were basically seeking to share maritime or ocean marine risks, so ship owners were effectively setting out to share those risks amongst themselves. If you ramp forward a little bit further and look at New England, there were textile mills that were seeking to address fire-related risks, obviously a key exposure in that period, so they were sharing fire risks amongst themselves. And then as a member of the Episcopal Church, I was interested to see that certainly the Episcopal Church plays a role here in the early part of the 1900s with regards to some of its cooperative sharing arrangements too, that in many ways look a lot like some of the things that we try to achieve with captive insurance organizations. Not listed here, but you might also add the reciprocal insurance arrangements that exist under law in many states, and some of the risk sharing that exists in those organizations. But let's move a little bit ahead to what maybe would be referred to as kind of the history of modern captives. So obviously what more of the discussion is gonna revolve around here today. And as you look at the literature, the consensus seems to be that basically if you think about the term captive insurer, most would credit a gentleman named Frederick Rice, who was from the state of Ohio, an insurance agent, broker, and actually a property protection engineer, at least by training. And he was operating in Youngstown, Ohio, and most trace back to the mid-1950s, where the term captive insurance organization first arose. Well, what did he do? Well, he established, he had a client, and I think this is interesting roots for the discussion of modern captives. He had a client, Youngstown Steel and Tube, that was obviously in the steel production business, and they were challenged with what we see a lot of organizations faced with that think about captives even in the modern environment, and that was the availability and cost of traditional insurance. So as a reaction to that, this organization formed its own wholly owned company, Steel Insurance Company of America, and that was sought to be a solution to this issue. Okay. Well, interestingly, and I have to confess, as much as I've been teaching about the subject of captives in my own classes, I didn't know this until I was doing some research in preparation for this talk, is why is it that they're called captive insurance companies? He's credited with coining the term, but why is it that they're actually called captive insurance companies? Well, as it turns out, Youngstown Steel and Tube had a series of mines that they owned to provide coke and iron ore for their smelting process. And those owned mines, Youngstown Steel and Tube called them captive mines. Okay, so they were owned by the organization called Captive Mines, and ultimately Fred Rice essentially adopted that same term to name this insurance organization. So ultimately that's where the name comes from. Frederick Rice also, interestingly, was responsible for a lot of what has happened in the Bermuda market as well. He's credited with setting up the first captive insurance company in Bermuda in 1962, International Risk Management Limited. So as we think forward, I think it's important for you to at least reflect, I'm going to offer at least, that I think it's important for you to reflect on the fact that, well, so where do captives kind of fit in to the overall risk management process? So I'll share just briefly that when you think about alternative risk transfer, so alternatives to traditional insurance, which obviously captives would be a special case of that, you would include things like self-insurance, so retentions, deductibles, and so forth that many of us individually, but certainly that corporations do. You think of captives, you think of risk retention groups, which I'll say a bit more about. But you also think about another area that's developing pretty actively currently, and that is the whole area of capital market securitization. We're only going to focus on captives, but I think it's just important to kind of position captives within that broader realm. It's estimated overall that the alternative risk transfer market is quite significant in business generally, estimated to be close to 30% of the overall commercial risk protection marketplace. Ultimately, what does that mean in terms of the captive market? Estimates back in 2010 at least indicated that the global captive insurance premiums were roughly $55 billion U.S., and that's made up by close to 50 or 60% of that market share is made up by U.S. organizations. Okay, so obviously a very important technique and tool within the overall risk management marketplace. So let's turn our attention a little bit now specifically to captives, and I'll share with you also again just to provide a bit of a foundation for the discussion that will come in the subsequent panels, is to say a little bit about how might we define a captive. And there are a variety of definitions, but I would argue that most share some of the key elements that you'll see here in this one that I wanted to present to you. So it's a subsidiary owned by one or more parent companies, and we'll talk a little bit about the various types, that's established primarily to ensure the exposures of its owner or owners. Okay, so that's ultimately at the core, at least, what by and large a captive represents. In that context, and again, making sure to provide some of that framework, in the risk management context, captives really represent both a tool of retention. Companies are ultimately using this as an alternative to risk transfer through insurance, typical insurance, or traditional insurance, but it's also an element of risk financing as well. Okay, so a combination of those elements is really what we see. So as we think about the benefits, and there are certainly many others that some of you may be aware of or that you might add to this list, but I think these at least describe some of the core ones that are often pointed to in terms of what might be motivating an organization to contemplate the structuring and formation of a captive. Probably first and foremost, although these are not all in a particular order, is the notion of a broader coverage. Okay, I happen to serve on the board of a hospital. We do not have a captive, but many hospital and healthcare organizations do. And in many cases, one of the motivations is that they have a little more flexibility about forms and some of the coverages that might be embedded, or how we merge policies, things of that sort. Back to its core, why did Fred Rice think of the idea and establish a captive? Because of availability and pricing of insurance. I think that's at the core for a lot of organizations in terms of why they may consider this as an alternative. So the ability to have a bit more control over the stability of pricing and coverage availability. I'll share with you a little bit about market cycles, but certainly those do have an impact on captive formation. Improve cash flow. So an important motivation in most organizations is that they feel they may have a little bit more control over their cash flow realization through a captive arrangement. This can come from various sources. You know, even as simple as just, when do I have to pay the premiums? What are my obligations there? What are some of the control that I might have around premium payments, how frequently, and so forth? A bit more control than if I'm dealing with a traditional insurer, okay? Two, investment realization, mitigation of some of the expenses that would be associated with a third-party traditional insurance kind of arrangement would all potentially contribute to this notion of improved cash flow. Increase control over the program. Obviously, if I'm the owner of the organization, I've got more ability to influence investment strategy and some of those policies that ultimately in a traditional insurer, I would be unable to at least have direct control over some of those things. And then finally, the last one I want to emphasize for just a moment, because this is not something that you necessarily see in a lot of the kind of traditional lists of benefits of captives, but I think one that's very important to emphasize, is keep in mind that as a technique of retention and risk financing, a captive really can be an alternative to simply retaining the risk, right? Simply self-insuring the risk. And what I think is important to realize, and I think many companies realize this through the captive formation process, is the discipline around structuring a captive, operating something that is equivalent to an insurance company in many aspects, provides a discipline around pricing, reserving, and things of that sort that may or may not be quite as explicit in the context of a more traditional just self-insurance or retention strategy. So I think that's definitely one to keep in mind as you think about some of the motivations that firms have. A few words about enabling legislation. Obviously, there's a lot that could be said here, but again, I'm attempting really just to provide a bit of a foundation. Some of the key enabling legislation, as noted, there's certainly been captive organizations formed prior to some of these, but two acts that are fairly seminal in the formation and further growth of captives traditionally or in the modern period are the Bermuda Insurance Act of 78 and then the Vermont Captive Law that was established in 1981. Certainly these were important periods relative to the initiation of a lot of captive formations in the modern period. Additionally, there are some other states that had early laws. Kind of interesting to see this. Colorado and Virginia both have still relatively few. Virginia, to the best of my knowledge, had no captives at this current time, but this is an evolving period, so it may have changed, but that was the best data I had. Colorado, most recently, only three captives, okay? Tennessee, on the other hand, did not have a lot of growth in its captive formations, but that's changed in more recent periods. But again, these were some of the earlier laws that were established. And then, as I think most of you are probably aware, I always tell my students, if you can't think of any other answer as to why a company did something, then taxes is always a good one to give a shot at, because it certainly does tend to have at least some impact on some of the decisions and motivations that you'll see affecting decisions. So clearly this is an area where there was a lot of uncertainty relative to the IRS in the U.S., but certainly some other taxing authorities in terms of their posture towards captives. If you look back, many court decisions, lots of case law that evolved, but many of the sources point to 2001, when UPS had a ruling that essentially started to sort of stabilize some of the interpretation around whether or not captives could be treated in a more favorable context relative to taxation. So again, many other developments that occurred over time, but that certainly has been a change because the IRS particularly was very adverse to the captive notion from a deductibility perspective until some of these subsequent rulings. All right, so let me share with you just a little bit on numbers. This is annually, a little small up on the screen, but the trend is really the important thing. This goes back to the early 80s. As I mentioned to you, that's when a lot of the early laws were established. You can see there were already existing captives there, but we go from roughly 1,000 in the early 80s up to close to 6,900 in the most recent year 2014. So again, various numbers that can be found, but there seems to be at least general agreement around these ballpark figures. The other thing I wanted to point out to you though in this slide is that historically captives have been an important alternative to traditional insurance, and so as a result, in periods of challenges within the traditional insurance market, high premiums, hard markets as we would often describe those, we tend to see a reaction that captives might be more favorable in that light. So not particularly overwhelming, but I do think it's worth at least pointing out that you do see a little bit of that already in these aggregate data, that there are two periods there that you'll note kind of an uptick in captive formations, and those do roughly overlap with some periods of hard market activity in the traditional insurance markets, okay? I don't note it here, but you can also see that there was a bit of a deceleration after the financial crisis as well as there was in businesses generally. Okay, so at any rate, this does impact. Now, one footnote with regards to looking at numbers, very important, hard to find the data on this, but it's also the case that many organizations are differentially utilizing their captives. So this is aggregate number of captives in existence, but it doesn't really capture how intensively companies might be utilizing a captive in a given period. So that certainly would be an important part of this kind of a result as well. Okay, quickly, not maybe surprising to many of you, but I did want to share, these are the largest domiciles currently. Certainly familiar to many of us that Bermuda has historically had a leading role here in this context. The Cayman Islands, quite a large number of captives. As some of you may be familiar, the Cayman Islands has really developed an expertise on the healthcare side. So many of their captives are oriented towards healthcare-related organizations in terms of the captives in that market. Largest domicile in the U.S., Vermont, again, perhaps not a surprise to most of you. The two that have grown pretty quickly, and I'll show you some other information on this, are Utah and Delaware. So they've grown pretty quickly in recent periods. And Aguila, which is in the Eastern Caribbean, is the other one that's listed up here. So what are some of the drivers in the growth of captive organizations? Again, no list will be absolutely complete. Drivers of growth offshore. Okay, so as you may be familiar, a lot of the development in the early stages of the modern captive period was in offshore domiciles such as the Cayman Islands and Bermuda. Okay. Why is that? Well, captive insurers were really, in the earliest stages, required to effectively meet all the requirements of a traditional insurer, okay? True in the U.S., true in the U.K., true in many other domiciles as well. So they were required to hold the same amount of capital and meet many of the same requirements, and obviously that was challenging if a company wished to establish its own captive insurer. Take Germany as an example, the second item here, tariff arrangements. Europe had a very highly prescriptively regulated insurance market. Rates were very highly regulated. And as a result, there was really not much of a capability to take advantage of retentions to the extent that we would normally expect in traditional insurance markets. And so that put some pressure on organizations to think about, was there an offshore strategy around captives that might make sense? As we've already commented, as I'd already mentioned, flexible regulation in the offshore domiciles was what started to become very attractive around rates, forms, and certainly on investment strategies and policies as well. But as I'll also try to comment quickly again, just to set the foundation for subsequent discussions to come, is that we've seen some very interesting evolution in the U.S. domiciles over the last 10 years, and you'll see some corresponding growth numbers there that reflect how the U.S. domiciles have really started to change their perspective on captives. Okay, so what is it that organizations are often looking for, and what are some of the elements that domiciles utilize to try to attract captives? I think most of these will be relatively clear to you. Certainly, I've emphasized the point of investment strategy. The U.S. industry is an example, but certainly many other insurance industries across the U.S. Regulation is relatively prescriptive around investment holdings, fairly conservative, and therefore some of the flexibility that isn't available there has been allowed in captive organizations. So that's certainly one aspect that has been used. Capitalization requirements, so differential capitalization requirements for captives is certainly another tool that's used to attract business. But I wanted to mention these last two for us with a little more emphasis, because I think they're the most relevant to a regulatory audience like this, and that is, one, legislative responsiveness. You can pass the law, but if you're not quick to think about what some of the other adjustments or implications are that might be necessary, what we've seen is domiciles have had differential success if the goal is attracting captive formations around how responsive the domicile is from a legislative perspective. Okay, and obviously insurance departments don't control that. That's the legislature. On the infrastructure support side, and this could be the industry itself, what's available to support the business in that domicile, but focusing here for a minute on departments of insurance, the other issue that's been interesting to follow across different domiciles is just how well the DOI is set up to deal with captive arrangements, how responsive they can be, and what sort of expertise is there, and so forth. So you do see some differentials there across different domiciles, and that seems to be influential in terms of formations. Okay, so here for the U.S., you'll start to see a little bit more. This slide just tracks kind of numbers of captives in more recent period. A few things just quickly to point out on this slide. Vermont has maintained a high number of domiciliary companies and has certainly been relatively stable in that position. Hawaii, this is not intended to be an exhaustive list, but Hawaii is another domicile that's been available and fairly successful for a long period of time, but you can see that their numbers have been relatively stable over that extended period as well. DC I threw in just because we're here, but at any rate, obviously they've been a relevant player here in the domiciliary position as well, some growth there. But very dramatically, you see what's happened in Utah and Delaware. So just interesting to see some of the differences that has been occurring across the different U.S. domiciles. So let me say just a few words about the structures that exist. Again, at a relatively high level, the panelists will be in a good position to comment on questions that get into a little bit more of the behind the scenes details, but let me just run through this quickly, okay? So different words out there. This is an attempt to get sort of the most consistent descriptors, but again, not right or wrong. There are obviously different terms that are used for some of these particular arrangements. Single parent, okay? So single parent obviously just defines that there's one owner, but obviously a one owner could also insure more than just themselves, okay? So a pure captive, as the term is often used, means one owner, one insured, okay? But a single parent captive doesn't necessarily imply that. It may imply, it only implies that there's a single owner, and they may actually be operating also as a profit center or just as a operation to insure others besides just the parent company. Group or association captives, if you're an accountant, you may know that the AICPA has a captive for professional liability. That would be an association captive. You see some of these roots already in the earlier history that I mentioned before. Group captive, same idea, multiple owners, multiple insureds, but simply, not necessarily affiliated through an association arrangement. Rent-a-captive. I've always told my students I would love to see the risk manager that went into the CFO and said he had this really sophisticated risk financing strategy, and the CFO's like, oh my gosh, tell me what that is, and he says, rent-a-captive. And I'm thinking that would have to be a tough sell, but at any rate, terminology that has stuck. Rent-a-captive is the notion that you've got a captive organization that's willing to essentially loan out some of its capacity to other organizations. So it's often viewed as a way for organizations to get into the captive business without necessarily all the upfront costs that might be incurred by establishing a separate and independent captive organization. Risk retention groups, very parallel to captives, but as many of you may know, these are enabled by federal law, two laws, 81 and 86, that were focused on liability, and these can be domiciled, so enacted by federal law, but must be licensed in one state, and then they have authority to write in other states, but in many ways work much like some of the captives that we're talking about. A lot of words in this next point, but I did want to at least call to your attention because this gets talked about a good bit. People talk about sponsored captives or segregated cells or cell captives, protected cells. In my research, much of the variation is really around what domiciles use as the terminology for these. So they at the core, most are essentially a rent-a-captive concept, okay? But legally in those domiciles, the assets and the liabilities are completely separated out from a legal perspective. So functionally, at least from an economics perspective, work much like a rent-a-captive, but again, more specifically identified in those jurisdictions, and I've noted here what the terms are that they use in some of those domiciles. I already mentioned reciprocal insurers. That's kind of an earlier concept too that has some captive elements potentially. Agency, you hear this sometimes, is typically an insurance agent or agency that has established a captive and makes it available for writing business for others. And then branch captives usually describe U.S.-based, not maybe exclusively, but U.S.-based branches of offshore companies, and often that's being done to utilize it for employee benefits risk, which is starting to become a very interesting area for a lot of organizations. So writing employee benefit risk for the company. Okay? The next I call applications. You could probably call these captive, other kinds of captives as well, but I know this is going to come up in some of the just applications for a second. So applications, not an exhaustive list, but conceptually, captives are typically used for a host of reasons that we otherwise could buy insurance for, okay? So general property casualty insurance, you know, some are intensively focused on property, some are intensively focused on liability. The hospital space, that's typically where that focus is. Professional liability, D&O, some organizations have used captives in those roles. Medical liability, again, as I've mentioned before, being fairly important. Fiduciary, employment practices liability, crime coverages are all out there. Increasing interest in thinking about captives as a potential tool around cyber exposures. So again, that's still emerging, but that's out there as well. Some organizations have used them in the context of their workers' comp risk exposures. And certainly very timely, sadly, is the terrorism issue. And there have been strategies there where companies have utilized their captives around terrorism risk. And then U.S. domiciled companies often are required by the feds to be part of the TRIA program. Other applications, and this I know will engender some of the discussion during the panels. Third-party business, maybe you're aware of this, but I always think it's an interesting piece to share. There are certainly companies out there that actively utilize their captives to write third-party business. What do we mean by third-party business? Well, often it's still tied to them, but it's maybe customers. Cell phone companies frequently are utilizing captives to write the warranties on the cell phones that they sell. Some of the consumer products warranties are done that way. Shipping transit coverage that might be offered to customers may be another example of a third-party risk that could be used, a captive could be used for that. There will, I know, be discussion around the life captives, and Commissioner Huff mentioned this in his opening remarks. Life captives are, not surprisingly, captives owned by life insurers. Often they're even often referred to as captive reinsurers because they tend to work in a way that they're transacting reinsurance. More discussion to come, but clearly, as was alluded to in the opening remarks, these were motivated, I think, heavily by the notion of statutory reserves being significantly different than arguably what economic reserves would be. This is very much a hot topic right now because the AG 48, Actuarial Guidelines 48, applicable for companies this year, does have some requirements in there with regards to security, letters of credit, things of that sort, the appropriateness of those tools for collateral and so forth. And all of this is kind of a precursor to the bigger issue of just when regulation of insurance reserves moves more towards principle-based reserving, you know, what will be some of the implications there. So a lot of room for discussion later on that. 831B captives, these are often either referred to as small or mini captives, been a lot of growth in these as well, and were enabled through federal law early on, at least from a tax perspective, hence the 831B reference, but there's certainly been a lot of activity in this sector in these very small captive insurers. Recently, at least I've only seen it recently, there's been a lot of discussion and activity around long-term care captives. All, you know, the population is aging, more and more people are taking advantage or needing skilled nursing facility care and things of that sort. So there's been some recent activity around organizations establishing captives to insure some of the liability, the medical or professional liability associated with that. And then the last item noted here are emerging risks. This is very much a work in progress, but I think I can just share with you a peek into the corporate sector. A number of organizations, as they've been building out their focus on enterprise risk management, obviously the ORSA requirements that apply through some of the regulatory environments in the U.S. are examples of firms being asked to think about enterprise risk management more, but many businesses are doing that independently of those regulatory requirements. And what they're finding is that they're identifying a number of risks that they maybe didn't fully appreciate, new risks that may not even be mature enough to be insured in the traditional insurance markets, and are thinking, I think, about ways in which they might use captives to address some of the financing around those emerging risks. So that's an area that absolutely will continue to grow and evolve. So as I think I'm right at the, maybe just a tad over the witching hour here, let me just conclude with a few quick comments. Hopefully you share with me an interest in kind of the origins of this interesting business tool, established to address a need, and certainly that's where a lot of our new ideas in business thinking tend to come from. Certainly the growth numbers I've shown you suggest that this has become a very popular tool in corporate risk management, and I think a lot of the trends I tried to share with you suggest that it will only continue to grow in that context, or at least there's a demand for that to happen. But important to state, and hopefully a bit obvious, is that with any strategy or tool, obviously it has the capability of addressing a very important business need, but there are also often challenges that may be presented if we don't have properly managed or controlled kinds of usage of those sorts of tools. So that's not unique to captives. It's typical of lots of business strategies that exist, and I think that's an important thing to keep in mind as you reflect on the role of captives as we go forward. My final item is just to point out to you that I'm happy to hear from you if there's any questions along the way that I can respond to. Our students at the University of Georgia would be very upset with me if I didn't also ask you, they'd especially like it if you would contact me if you have jobs for them. So you can contact me for any reason, but if you have a job for a student, we'd love to hear from you. So thank you very much for your attention. At this point, I will turn it over to Commissioner Nickel, who's going to come forward and introduce our next panel. Thanks for your attention.